So they're trying to take me over to the table, and they're trying to get me to lay down on the table. And I said, wait a minute, you know, just answer, just tell me, where am I, you know? I just kept screaming. And but they weren't, you know, affected by what I was saying at all. And I know they could hear me because when they were wrestling me down, I could see a little wince when I was really loud in what I was screaming. But the expression didn't seem real angry or aggressive or anything like that. There was just this faint, tolerant sort of slightly annoyed look, you know, like a kid throwing a tantrum or something, you know. But they're trying to force me down, but there was three of them, and they were so much stronger than me, two men and a woman, that, and I was so weakened, you know, I was lucky to be able to stand up. But in spite of that, my fear, I was able to get one hand loose, and I got my finger under the edge of the mask. They put this mask on my face, and I started to pull it away. But before I could, boom, I was out. I've worked with the artist and did a lot of drawings to get as close as what I could. It's like working with a police sketch artist. He kind of got overdone with their bodies, but as far as the face is concerned, pretty darn close, but there was just something odd about the eyes I never could quite ever put my finger on. But interesting that the female had a longer hair and the man, you know, like probably what current hairstyles would have been in the 70s. So that's one thing that made me assume they were from Earth, but there was something really odd about them. So, you know, right now I don't think they were from Earth. You know, I think maybe the hairstyles had to do with some kind of effort to blend in, that they maybe were here with the idea of moving amongst Earth people. When I regained consciousness, it wasn't slow and it wasn't painful or anything. I just came to. It was cold air, and I was lying face down, but my head was on my arm, not on the pavement. And there was a light above me, so I just looked to see where the light was coming from. But it went off just as I looked. So I don't know whether a light was turned off or a hatch closed or maybe some other glowing thing just quit glowing. Whatever it was, I'm looking at it for a few seconds there without any light, just hovering there in the dark, and then it just shot straight up into the sky. It didn't turn on edge. It just stayed with the bottom towards me and then just went straight up. And it moved so fast and was out of sight so fast, you'd think it would make a whooshing sound or a sound barrier sound, you know, but it was silent. It kind of moved the air a little bit, and I could feel a little bit of warmth. But other than that, but the main thing for me was this feeling of freedom, fresh air, cold, and, you know, the woods. And, you know, to me, that's my environment. It's where I worked every day, you know. So that felt like escape right at that moment. But I looked around and I recognized this stretch of road as leading down into Heber, the town nearest where this happened. And so that kind of renewed my energy a bit, and I took off running, you know, sort of fearful of being retaken, but desperate about, you know, the memory of these creatures and what I just experienced. You know, I just had this lingering, overpowering fear. It was psychological trauma, really deep. I went down into the town, banged on the door, and nobody came. I moved on down across the bridges and found a row of telephone booths and went into the first one. There was one on the right there, and it was out of order. And that was the last of my strength. But when I moved into the middle one, it worked. And I called my brother-in-law, and he thought it was a joke. Family had been getting crank calls over the previous days and started to hang up on me. Had a real sarcastic tone and said, I think you got the wrong number. But I screamed that it was me, and I somehow managed to convince him it was me. And he said, okay, I'll get your brother and come and get you. But, you know, I collapsed then, and I must have lost consciousness or something, because it seemed like, boom, they were there. But, you know, it took them at least half an hour, 45 minutes. And I really don't have any memory of that. But come to find out later that the operator had listened in on that phone call and notified the sheriff. And I mentioned that. Sheriff sent a man out there, but got there after my family did. So it in response to the allegation that our famous UFO skeptic there was saying that I was never there at all, that I was off somewhere else. He had several theories, you know. But anyway, to this day, those phone booths are there. They're not hooked up to anything anymore, but they're just, because the phone company knew it really happened and what happened there, they've left them there. And there, you know, there aren't any phone booths anywhere else in the entire area. So my family took me and put me in the truck, and I was trying to tell my brother what happened. And I was just sobbing and just could hardly speak. And he said something that about what had been happening over those previous days. And I, what? You know, he said, and he could understand for some reason that I thought this was still the same night. Because I could remember so little. But he said, Travis, you've been gone for 5 days. Feel your face. And I felt 5 day growth of beard, and I looked at my watch and the date had changed. And, you know, as trivial as that might seem in comparison to the rest of my experience, that was like the last straw. And I just couldn't talk anymore. Just what all this time, you know, but the family had been through a lot. It was already world news. Sheriff tried to keep these searchers, you know, to keep a lid on the news, but come to find out, they told, and there was already crews, media crews from England and Japan there, stomping through the flower beds and taking pictures through my mom's front window and through Steve's bedroom window and following the crew around and generally harassing everybody. So there was also these calls that I was talking about. There were some that were taken seriously. One call was from this lady that said that she had been a nurse working in a hospital, and this old couple had come in, and they just had an encounter with some kind of object, and she left, and when she came back on shift the next day, the couple was gone, the records were gone, and the rest of the staff were just acting like, no, this never happened. So she said, just watch out who gets a hold of him if he should ever be found. And another guy called and said that he was a former CIA. He seemed rational and sincere and gave left contact information and said the same thing, watch out about who gets a hold of him or he could, you know, disappear. So my brother did not think, well, let's get this guy to the sheriff. The town was a madhouse. Everything was crazy, and I was in a very fragile condition. And the only thing my brother was concerned with was getting me checked out medically, and that would have been really hard in that area because of all the hysteria that was going on. People were just, you know, please explain this away any way you can. So he took me to Phoenix right then, and during the search, he'd been approached by this UFO investigative group, and, which was sort of represented in the movie, you know, the wacko ones looking for a urine sample. And they had told my brother, you know, keep the first voided urine and bring it in for medical tests. And he said, we've got this doctor in our membership. We'll have him checked out. And so that was my brother's whole reason to take me to Phoenix. So he took us over there to this so-called medical doctor, and, you know, as unsophisticated as we were, we didn't take as long to figure out that this guy's no doctor, you know. Even looking at the urine sample, he acted like, ew, you know, get away from here, you know. So he was claiming to the media that he was a medical doctor, and then they pushed him on that, and then he said, well, I was a medic in the Marine Corps, you know. And then later on, Mike called up and interviewed him again. He says, no, I was never in the Marine Corps. You know, even though that was on video, I was in the Navy, medic in the Navy. So changing his story, but he was a total quack. You know, his degree were from a two-year institution that, you know, one of those diploma mills, they found out. Anyway, they went to the media, this loony group, and telling them, yeah, we got the case and said all this positive stuff. And as soon as we said, no, we're not having nothing more to do with you, because the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization contacted us and said, look, we've got real doctors in our membership, which they did. And they sent those over, get a house call, check me out, and then, you know, brought me into the office for further testing. You know, all that, you know, panned out. They were totally legit, and it was obvious they were. But this other group started, you know, just switched around and started attacking, saying, oh, he was in here and he's out been hallucinating on drugs. And that was the big story in the media then. But little did they know that I had blood and urine samples taken with these legitimate doctors who put them through the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's drug screen, which showed no trace of any drug in my body. But what the media wasn't asking, and what the people never thought to ask, was, well, you know, how do seven people have the same hallucination? You know, the whole idea, the first question was, were they drinking? Well, when does alcohol ever make people hallucinate? And when does it ever make seven people have the same hallucination? But then they tried to say I had a transitory psychosis. This one of the psychiatrists that come up with that interviewed me, and he could see that the hypnosis was genuine, and you know, he issued a statement to the media, you know, this conclusion is absolute, he's not hoaxing, he's not lying, he's been through a traumatic event, but he just couldn't accept the idea of UFOs, you know. And he compared the UFO experience, or my emotional state, to that of, you know, having experienced a death or a divorce or some really, you know, momentous calamity in my recent experience. But since he didn't believe it, he came up with the idea of a transitory psychosis. Went crazy, thought I experienced this, come back to normal. But how do you explain the other six guys? Were they in a transitory psychosis? You know, it just didn't make any sense, and nobody seemed to ask those kind of questions. Then another explanation was the hypnotist, Dr. James Harder with APRO, that he had planted these ideas in my head. But he didn't hypnotize the crew, and they saw what I saw. So, you know, people were desperate to explain it away. And, you know, just the planet Jupiter that was thrown out there, people just, oh, yeah, okay, fine. You know, it's like they were just eager to grab on to something that said this terrible thing can't happen around here. And so that was my battle in the initial months and years to follow, you know, is fighting off these accusations. And you know what? They never die. It's some of this stuff survives to this day on the internet. Things that have been refuted, things that have been disproved by documentation like medical tests and whatnot, the skeptics still put that out there in kind of a disinformation campaign. Just any way to explain it away. And I've tried to go on these sites that these skeptics maintain, and they'll accept negative comments from the public. But when I go on there and say, look, this is disproven and here's the proof, they won't even let me post. So you can see that they're not interested in revealing this horrible truth. It's propaganda, and they know it. And if it was fair and open, then the evidence that I'm citing and the proof that I give them would be included too. So it was a long, hard battle, and there was a lot that went on. But you know, over the years, a lot of stuff came out over time that. And there's my brother. He passed away February before last, and I really miss him. And I wouldn't have survived those first days after it happened without him. He was at his strongest when I was at my weakest. And I'll always be grateful to him for that. But this is L.J. Lorenzen. He was the director of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. At that time, the oldest and largest UFO investigative group. Good scientists, good doctors and people in their membership. And Jim Lorenzen was also a very scientific person himself. Dr. Harder here, he performed the hypnosis. He was professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And Dr. Leo Sprinkle was the director of counseling and testing at the University of Wyoming. And he reviewed my psychiatric tests, which proved there was no transitory psychosis. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, a famous astronomer from Northwestern University, who also met with me and announced to the public that Walton is not hoaxing and that I had been the subject of a lot of unfounded accusations. But the thing that dominated my nightmares for so long afterwards was these eyes, the stare that they gave me in that those few seconds in that standoff there by the operating table. And I think I know what might have caused that. One of the medical tests that I underwent was an EEG, a brain scan. And when they put me in there, this is one of the best brain places in the world, Barrow's Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. But they didn't tell the technician who I was or what I was in there for. I was just looking for some sign of injury. And in his report, he made note of an anomalous pattern that I think may have been the reason that this stare was so disturbing. I think they were trying to gain control of me at that moment. And the reason it was so unbearable was the intensity of their effort, but it wasn't working because of some brain injury that happened because of this energy blast that hit me. And so some of the follow-up research that I plan is to have another brain scan to see if that pattern is still there, to have the original test reviewed by a modern neuroscientist to see if what they can judge to be the reason for that particular pattern. And it would be interesting if it is still there and if it was the source of my ability to resist their control. You know, it'd be a pretty handy thing to have if I still have it. At least it'd be nice to walk around knowing I had that ability. But again, that was the subject of my nightmares. That was the main thing for quite a long time. Then eventually the dreams were no longer nightmares. They were just dreams, little glimmers of things involving the human-looking ones. But a lot of coincidences occurred in the intervening years, just remarkable things that just make you shake your head. And, you know, coincidence is a coincidence. Maybe it's just chance. But I was looking at this topographical map of the state of Arizona, and it was all divided up into about 75 different areas, but the area where the incident happened was Area 51. And it's just kind of an accident of numbering that is like a whole lot of the coincidences that came to bear in this whole incident. Like Robert Patrick, the one who played the crew boss, turned out his birthday was November 5th, the date that the incident happened. Another coincidence, Robert Patrick turned out to be Mike's cousin, the cousin of the man who's that he's playing. He was actually double cousins, cousins on two sides of the family. So a lot of strange coincidences. But one thing that came to light was we went back to the site for an interview and in 92, leading up to the movie. And I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, part of the reason the place, the exact spot was hard to find wasn't just that we hadn't been there in a long time and that there was so much snow there. It was because the tree growth had changed the look of that particular area. It turned out that later I found out that Mike, the crew boss, went back the following spring after the snow melted and discovered that the trees nearest to where the craft came down had grown much faster than they should have. And so he took a core sample, and this is an example of one of the many trees. The effect was greatest near where the craft came down and kind of faded away as you moved back into the woods, and then it was disappeared in all around. But this tree was 85 years old, but counting one ring for each year going back 15 years, the winter of 1975, you can see that a tree that was 85 years old at that point had doubled in diameter in 15 years. So, you know, the calculation was that this particular tree, at least, and, you know, most of the ones that were close, was producing wood fiber at 36 times the rate that it had before. Well, when I went back there winter before last with National Geographic, we were going to do some follow-up research, and we discovered a stump near ground zero, the center of the site, and this tree was cut in the logging operations that were immediately, the year immediately prior to the incident. And yet, here we had a 200-year-old tree. The significance of this discovery was that skeptics were saying, well, maybe there was just wet years right there. Maybe there was just some climate variation that made these trees grow faster. But here, a 200-year-old tree had rings that were had a very uniform amount of variation. And you can see in the earlier tree rings in this sample that you're looking at here that there is some variation, but it's not anything like what occurred after that point. And in this 200-year-old tree, you know, you have a benchmark, a record of the kind of growth conditions right there at that spot on that ridge going back 200 years, and there was no extraordinary variation like you see from 1975 to 92. And that was very exciting for me to discover, but yet National Geographic was turning the whole thing into a big joke. So if you see any kind of UFO-related show by National Geographic, they're not serious. You know, it's, you know, their nature stuff, their science stuff is top rate, top notch, but they don't have any respect for UFO cases. I spent 3 days with them, and they just focused on totally ridiculous stuff. The scientists that they brought with them took samples. I took some samples, fortunately. So it's documented that this 200-year-old benchmark, you know, they witnessed, you know, that this came off of a stump, you know, in the ground there. But they never followed up with any of the research that we were there for. We were to record and check for the magnetic readings that the scientists had that the researchers had found at the site during the search, had these real high magnetic readings and a polarity reversal at one side of the clearing. And we wanted to follow up and see if the radiation was still there, but they insisted on going in winter and there was 2 feet of snow on the ground. And then they said, well, water blocks radiation, so we can't do that test. So basically you got a show where this girl's climbing the tree, screaming the whole time, and I still don't know why she was climbing the tree, but I guess they thought that made for interesting film. And then when we left, they put these cameras and these night vision cameras on themselves and started walking around saying, oh, is there bears out there? Well, you know, there's 2 feet of snow, so there was no bears. But they said, oh, we better get out of here. And that's how they ended the show. It's just, it was a big ridiculousness. But anyway, so I'm going to be doing some follow-up on research at the site. I'm trying to move along here and cover this is a diagram and calculations on the tree growth. And I got a hold of a Freedom of Information Act request on Philip Klass, our UFO skeptic there. The FBI had a file on him, and there's a memo in there. Now, you notice that secret and confidential and all that stuff has been X'd out. So this has been released because the case is now closed because he's passed on. But I don't think this is the correct document, but there is one memo from J. Edgar Hoover himself to the director of the CIA turning the whole matter over to them. And, you know, it is standard CIA recruiting methods to get something on somebody and then get their cooperation. I don't think it was necessary to bring in the CIA to get Philip Klass to be a UFO skeptic. He was already a skeptic, but they were able to, you know, bankroll and control and guide his efforts probably a little more vigorously than he would have, and maybe bankroll things like $10,000 offers. During the aftermath of the incident, Steve Pierce, the youngest guy on the crew, was brought a message by a local deputy, Click, from Philip Klass, offering him $10,000 to deny that this incident happened, to claim it was a hoax. And Steve never accepted the offer because, you know, he just couldn't bring himself to lie about it, even though he's desperate for the money. But, you know, this FBI file was very interesting because it was sort of the smoking gun on the, was he really secretly a government agent? But maybe this is the FBI. No, this is the one to Strategic Air Command. They're holding the case in what is called RUC, remains under consideration or something. So basically they had an axe to hold over his head. But here's some of the quotations from some of the files, you know. Klass is well known to us. This is the FBI talking. He's deficient on all points of his argument, particularly concerning the credentials of Dr. Hynek, which could scarcely be better. On the other hand, Klass has no such sterling reputation and has twice been under FBI connection with the unauthorized publication of classified information. This was in connection with his job at an aerospace magazine. His previous communications generally have been accusatory or argumentative in nature. And then later on, BUFILE, which is an abbreviation for Bureau of FBI File, 62 blah, 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 serial 7, states that in view of Klass's intemperate criticisms and often irrational statements he made to support them, it was recommended that the Bureau be most circumspect in any future contact with him. But, you know, what's really interesting is this next one. BUFILE discloses that Klass has, from time to time, come to our attention by virtue of the fact that he has been in, and then there's 9 lines that are taken out right there. That's a big chunk. And then this Bureau, partial line, redact, and then this is the key phrase, and not to be of assistance to his government. That's the one where I think that's suggestive that they're trying to recruit him. But since the classified information could not be declassified for purposes of prosecution, no action was taken. But we know that's kind of a lame excuse not to prosecute. Otherwise, you'd never be able to prosecute anybody for releasing classified information if you couldn't discuss it in court. You know, that'd let everybody off. And then, like I said, RUC status. So they held that over his head, in my view. But anyway, a lot of interesting stuff in connection with this government disinformationist stuff. There was a call that came in right before the release of the movie. This guy said that he was deer hunting in the area at the time that it happened, and he was with his wife, who he's now divorced from. And even though, you know, she's divorced, he would back up what he was saying, that they were on the next ridge and that they saw the glow of the craft and the beam. And that at that time, and I didn't think anything out of the ordinary when he first told me this, that he was in the military. He was in military intelligence. You know, I should have been ringing alarm bells. You know, What is somebody with military intelligence coincidentally being the only deer hunter close enough to see this incident from the next ridge? He said that he went to his superior officers and asked him if he should come forward. These men were accused of murder. And so his superior said, unless they're actually indicted, stay out of it.